Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Alan Finlayson, professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia in Britain, on the ideology of Bonoism and its affinities to modern corporate ideology. And then we'll hear from Betsy Hartman, director of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College, on the timeless appeal of Parson Thomas Malthus. First up, Alan Finlayson. As I was talking with a friend about my interview the other week with Harry Brown, author of Front Man, the splendid polemic against Bono, just out in Verso's Counterblast series, she sent me a copy of a paper by Alan Finlayson on the ideology of Bonoism, which is actually far larger than the man whose government name is Paul Hewson himself. The paper, Cameron, Culture and the Creative Class, The Big Society in the Post-Bureaucratic Age, appeared last year in the academic journal The Political Quarterly. In it, Finlayson argues that Bono's worldview has substantial affinities with modern corporate ideology, which is emphatically not square, but imagines itself endlessly creative, revolutionary, and capable of solving social problems in ways far beyond the capacity of moribund state bureaucracies. This philosophy manifests itself in the thinking of high-tech philanthropists, in TED Talks, and in our Democratic Party and the UK's Tory and Labour parties. You could even hear a version of this sort of thing from American anarchists. It was pervasive during the Occupy days and lingers on today. It is a philosophy of symbol manipulators like code jockeys and ad copywriters and even hip financiers. Alan Finlayson is a professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia in Britain. Alan Finlayson. Welcome, Alan Finlayson. Bonoism is a coherent ideology. It's not just that Bono is an annoying and bombastic figure, but is a bearer of a certain political philosophy. What are the salient features of Bonoism?
Well, he may be those things, though, but bombastic and irritating. But he's also, I think, indicative of a particular melange of cultural outlooks and sensibilities and of a way of thinking about society and politics. So if you think about the way Bono presents himself, on the one hand, he presents himself as this kind of countercultural figure, the kind of guy who wears sunglasses to see the Pope, doesn't ever wear a suit and tie, likes to play the role of the rock star. At the same time, he wants to be someone who works really at the heart of formal politics, shaping policies and talking about social responsibility and trying to show that one can be cool and one can be corporate at the same time. And Bonoism for me is about exactly that. How do you maintain the idea that you're some countercultural anti-establishment figure at the same time as you devote yourself to the furtherance of the establishment and fulfill yourself through doing both?
As I was reading a piece, I was reminded of some of the stuff that Tom Frank was writing in the late 90s about how capitalism was so revolutionary. It was, the revolutionary force in the world. It was kind of cool and groovy, and, you know, all that square stuff from the 50s is now out the window, and struck by how Bono seems to bring that into the 21st century.
That's exactly right. From the kind of cold, mechanistic organisation of the 1950s. Out of that came the critique of the man and of the system and the desire for self-expression and individuality that manifested itself in certain parts of the 60s counterculture. And what we now see, pretty well developed at the present moment, I would say, is an ideology that claims that anti-system individualism in the name of the capitalist system itself. And so that actually to be a good capitalist, you should be creative and destructive at the same time. That's the way to be successful in business. That's the essence of the capitalist system. And that enables a claim that, therefore, really the people who are cool and anti-establishment individualists aren't the ones who are criticising capitalism, perhaps advocating state-based social programmes, but those who are opposed to the state and its social interventions and in favour of a capitalism that will enable us all to be free, expressive, creative individuals.
Yeah, for a guy who's involved in politics as much as he is, he is somewhat skeptical of traditional statist solutions, right?
Exactly. So what you find Bono campaigning for is not just, but he does campaign for some changes to state policies and state actions, but he doesn't present his politics in terms of collective action or action on the part of the state that is designed to produce some kind of structural change and therefore measurable policy outcome. What you see Bono doing is trying to make a case that we can all be part of He always uses these kinds of terms, the adventure. We can all be part of the journey. We can all transform the world by transforming ourselves. And what emerges then is that what's most important really in the Bonoist ideology is that self-realization, that self-expression, and therefore a form of political action that doesn't hinder or limit that self-expression, that isn't therefore contained by the procedures and processes of traditional party politics or by the constitutional limitations of traditional national politics, but one that is there to enable the fullest expression of the individual will, one that enables the individual to demonstrate to themselves and to other people their capacity to have a good will, have a good heart, and through their commitment, their daring and their innovation to change the world forever.
You say for the Bonoist, change is a state of mind. What do you mean?
Right. Well, so part of what this whole ideological cultural assemblage is dealing with is the current stage of what you might call kind of hypercapitalism, late capitalism, the rapidity of transformations in products and markets and workplaces and so forth. And that has, of course, completely unsettled all sorts of traditions from both the left and the right. It's unsettled traditional notions of national culture. It's unsettled traditional notions of work and the workplace. And it's unsettled work itself, making life rather precarious for millions and millions of people. So what the Bonoist ideology is saying is, look, actually, this instability, this endless transformation, this shifting, this isn't a bad thing at all. This is exactly how it should be. And in fact, this is giving you an opportunity to embrace the possibilities of permanent change and transformation. You see, if the archetypal individual of mid-century capitalism is the suburban, suit-wearing, middle management employee who has a variety of clearly defined interests in terms of the housing market, job prospects, family life, and so on, then the ideal individual of the Bonoist world is defined by his, and is usually his, capacity for creative self-expression, for originality, and therefore it's this. What capitalism grants therefore, is the right to be creative, to be an originator of action, to express himself through the work he does.
Now, you said usually his, and I noticed you said that in the article as well. Is this something masculinist about the Bonoist ideology?
I think there is. I mean, I'm sure men and women could express it equally, but I think there is something masculinist in it because of the way in which it emphasizes this singular capacity to create in a way which must then be seen and admired by others. So there's that. The Bonoist doesn't just want to do good or to display a work, but wants others to recognise that and see that this is what he is doing, that this is what he is creating. And that, I think, is part of a lineage of a certain kind of both romantic aesthetic sensibility as well as a political sensibility that has a long tradition of being associated with particularly gendered conceptions of what counts as work and what counts as creativity.
He's something of a heroic quester in the romantic sense, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, he's looking for the hero's journey, right? He's looking for the adventure. We could all go on this adventure and be changed at the end of it. And that's part of what's the appeal of it for people, he thinks, is the capacity to change yourself, not merely adhere to some kind of higher moral good or some clearly specified outcome, but also fulfilling your nature as someone who transforms and then displays that transformation to people and shows what works you have wrought on the world.
You say politics is deeply aestheticized for him. What's the role of art and music in the Bono worldview?
Well, there's a lot of things one could say about that. I mean, on the one hand, what we see, Bono is an example of the way in which activity in the creative and cultural industries can now afford some people a particular public platform and a position from which to articulate a political case, make arguments, form alliances with mainstream political systems. But I think there's more to it than that, which is fundamentally this idea that the capacity for creative originality is now seen as being the essential characteristic of human beings, not the capacity to transform nature through our labour, nor the capacity for purely selfish individual acquisition, nor even the capacity to form a variety of social relationships, but specifically to do something new and display something new. So the arts become an archetypal expression of that possibility, and then it becomes possible to claim that actually other things really should be seen as being artistic activities, so that organizational management becomes an art properly conceived. Those who manipulate symbolic forms and figures, be it in financial markets or public relations, become artistic individuals. And so and music, particularly popular rock music, is a kind of perfect expression for that ideology of what creativity should be, particularly in rock music, in which the creator is very visible, doesn't hide behind the work of a poem or the work of painting, but displays themselves and makes themselves the work of art, along with the noisy expression that they demand you pay attention to.
It's the singer, not the song, as the Rolling Stones said.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely, in Bono's case, yeah.
I'm speaking with Alan Finlayson, Professor of Political and Social Theory at the University of East Anglia in Britain. Bono's also famous for being religious. What is the theology of Bono?
That's a really good question. There is a kind of theological dimension to it, in the sense that there's a spiritual aspect to it, if you like, that the part of what the appeal is of the journey, the adventure, the self-creation, is that this is part of you fulfilling your spiritual as well as your material needs at the same time. However, I don't think that one could reduce it to some kind of traditional theism. As I said earlier, it's not about adherence to a clearly specified moral goal that exists independently of you. It's about living by the norms that you create in your own action and in your own transformation of the world. In that sense, what happens is that the Bonoist figure doesn't so much worship a god as become his own god, with a capacity for a kind of divine innovation and originality.
He's also not a Puritan god.
No, absolutely not. No. He's and you can see this as having its roots back in certain forms of 60s spirituality, I suppose, as well. Enjoying yourself is also a demonstration of your success and how in tune you are with the world. Being able to be relaxed about, you know, certain hedonistic pleasures, not being moralistically judging about every aspect of other people's behaviours. As long as people are doing what they want, and they're doing it in their own way and expressing themselves, then that's a good thing.
The creative class, Richard Florida, there are some affinities there too, aren't there?
Absolutely. The reason I want to write about Bonoism wasn't just because of an interest in Bono particularly, but to take him as an example of this broader way of looking at the world, this ideology. And that ideology, I would suggest, is in fact the distinct expression of this particular class formation, what Richard Florida celebrates as the creative class. And that is this class of people whose employment and activity comes from their constant shifting, reshifting and manipulation of various symbolic forms, from their use of means and modes of expression, that doesn't necessarily lead to some tangible physical product that we can see, but does deal with ideas, emotions, feelings, thoughts, and so forth. What's happening, I think, as is always the case really, is that a particular class fraction achieving some level of dominance tends to see its way of experiencing and viewing the world as the way of viewing and experiencing the world, and therefore thinks that everybody should live like that, not just for its own self-interest, but because it thinks it would be in everybody's interest to live exactly as they do. And I think this is exactly what you see in Bonoism and in the broader politics around it. And you see it manifested in, for instance, things like TED Talks, where a kind of creative class, technologically, aesthetically oriented, comes together and celebrates itself. You see it in the way in which, particularly in those TED Talks, one discovers that creativity, innovation, originality, and so forth are actually biological, hardwired features of our evolutionary psychology. But you also see it in government policies, certainly in the UK, on the one hand, policies to promote certain kinds of creativity and innovation, never through actually free expressive arts, but through engagement in activities that make children see themselves as empowered to be entrepreneurial subjects, but also in the UK in a range of policies that try to creatively shape the way individuals behave in their environment by designing creative policies, images, themes and styles that will motivate people to do the things that they really ought to do if they were living as proper creative class individuals should.
Now, I wonder how much of this ideology seeps into, I don't know, a bond trader in the city of London. Is this a certain sector of people who write and speak design ads for a living, or is this a broader feature of the capitalist class today?
I think it is a broader feature. I wouldn't make the claim that every capitalist thinks exactly the same way, and clearly part of what is happening is that more traditional capitalists perhaps are happy to align themselves with a cultural ideological view that advances their interest in the short term as they see it. But I think that capitalists are also victims of their own cultural creations, if you like. And there is clearly an element of, say, even the most successful financial classes that certainly firstly allies itself to the kind of easygoing libertarian side of Bonoism that doesn't really care about drug usage that much, doesn't care about people's sexualities, family lives and so forth, and therefore wants to see itself as going along with that kind of cultural viewpoint. But I think there's also something more becoming clearer, which is around the whole ideology of corporate social responsibility. Now, in the past, corporate social responsibility has certainly looked like a view that really is a way of marketing one's products a little bit better, demonstrating that one seemingly cares about the environment or about the poor or about school children, whatever it might be. But I think there's actually more going on in that ideology of corporate social responsibility, because there's also within there a claim that people should be thinking politically and socially not only in their private lives as citizens, or not only in their formally political lives as members of parties or trade unions, but also as members of workplaces, as members of industrial or management organisations, as employees or owners of those kinds of corporate enterprises. So that CSR begins to say, look, actually, don't just market yourself as a responsible organisation. You should be a responsible organisation. You shouldn't just respond to changes in the world. You should be leading changes in the world. That's what you're supposed to do. And because you are the creative, originating, innovating people, you should apply your ingenuity not just to your business, but use your business to apply ingenuity to all sorts of other things. And then that legitimates the increased involvement of private corporations in education, in this country, in health in particular sorts of ways, and in universities as well, of course. And it becomes not just a way of saying, oh, these ought to be involved in what were previously public activities because it's unfair to have state monopolies and so forth, but actually these become necessary participants because they're the source of the true imagination, of the true invention that can transform these services and make them even better and make them fit for the 21st century, that can make them properly wired using all the latest big data and so on and so forth. And I think there's an extent to which that ideology is fully bought into by participants. They don't just think that they can make a fast buck out of running the schools. They really, really, really think that they know how to run schools better than people who just happen to be, you know, teachers.
Yes. What you describe here, the corporate social responsibility and, you know, the creative approach to the business world, where everyone is an entrepreneur, is also a substitute for traditional state things like regulation. This is like freer and non-coercive than traditional state regulation would be.
Yes, absolutely. So part of the argument is that given that all history is really driven by creative entrepreneurial individuals, if we want things to work better or work out as well as they might, we have to make sure that those individuals are as free to be creative and original as they possibly can be. So then there's an argument against the withdrawal of too much state regulation or too much state interference. So in this country, for instance, the current Conservative-led coalition has in the past talked about something it calls the post-bureaucratic age. A bit of a mouthful, and not a term they often put to the front of their speeches anymore. But I think it's essential to understanding what's going on, certainly in the case of the British government. So the idea of the post-bureaucratic age is to say that we've moved out of the 20th century period when things had to be centralised, whether it was in government or in corporations or whatever it might be. We've now moved to a stage beyond the rule of the bureaucrat, the rule of the office with its procedures and its structures and its hierarchies. We've moved beyond partly because we've become fully developed individuals who recognise our capacity for originality, but also because of technological change, also because the internet and the capacities for making available data of all kinds, this has made possible a new kind of transparency and a new kind of openness, which is going to be good if we embrace it fully and embrace it properly, because it will help everybody to more properly ensure that things get to the right places. It will help consumers to perform the regulatory functions that were once performed by the law and by the state, because consumers will check what products are being made, the conditions they're made in, whether they think that they're ethically sound or not. Consumers will compare schools' results, hospitals' results. They'll compare all sorts of things. They'll be able to see fully whether the local government or national government is spending the money where it said it would spend it. And so they'll be able to hold governments to account through this new transparency.
I'm speaking with Alan Finlayson, Professor of Political and Social Theory at the University of East Anglia in Britain. This sounds, it has a lot in common with the ideology of parts of the Democratic Party here. Certainly Obama talks like this sometimes, and some of the high-tech Democrats, the New America Foundation, people like that. But it's very important presence in the British Tory Party.
Absolutely. No, it's an important presence in the British Tory Party, as it was, I think, in Blair's Labour Party beforehand. The idea that through this new technology, through a range of smart, they love the word smart, of course, smart applications of various kinds, things could be done cheaper, better, more efficiently, but also in ways that would be led by individuals or groups of individuals, crowdsourcing, which is a way of not talking about collective action of any particular kind. And it has been key to parts of the current coalition government. So, for instance, Cameron's first key political advisor was a man called Steve Hilton, whose partner happens to be one of the vice presidents at Google. And some of his policy recommendations were all about bringing forward data on crime statistics in local areas, then enabling people to elect police commissioners, which is a new development in this country. So you're trying to tie together the capacities to get data, to release data, and then have individuals make decisions on that kind of basis. And of course, that's a very appealing narrative that seems to fit with the experience that a lot of us have using the internet to check travel arrangements, train fares, different prices of things and so forth. So it speaks to a certain kind of common sense, but actually it's beginning to become clear that it's also a way of trying to reconceive how government will work, and conceiving it in a way that radically individualises politics. So it's not about citizenship or party membership and the kinds of old-fashioned disputes and difficulties that we used to have. It's about simply making available all this information, and then, just as in the free market in economic goods, so the free market in ideas and the free market in politics will spontaneously or magically resolve things. And you find that kind of ideology across, in some respects, the political spectrum. You can find it in parts of what might be seen as far-right libertarianism. You can find it in the not-so-right-wing contemporary leaders of the Conservative Party in Britain. You can find it in the Democrat Party, as you say. You can even find it in relation to movements like WikiLeaks, this idea that just by bringing out data, presenting it in ingenious ways, and leaving it to the spontaneous creativity of individuals, everything will be all right.
Well, it even sounds like some of the ideology of the Occupy movement, American anarchism.
Right, because they're all sitting there on the laptops tweeting the information, and that's going to make it all fine, and we don't need to think about longer-term organisation and structures, or even about, in some senses, background analyses of how political systems and structures might actually work. There's a lot of faith put in to the idea that everything is changing anyway, and if you're in tune with that change, you will somehow be able to lead and shape it. I mean, I have a huge amount of sympathy for what the Occupy movement was expressing and what it was trying to do, but I think part of it, the tension within it, was it was trying to balance out this idea of an unfettered individual spontaneity as an expression of one's true political self with the actual implementation of some kind of political strategy, which is always about rather more than just what one feels like at that moment.
So then, finally, the austerity that Cameron is now famous for can be seen not as defending the interests of greedy rich people who don't want to share their resources with the non-rich, but in fact a liberating act of lifting the dead hand of bureaucracy.
Exactly. That's exactly what they've done. I mean, one of the questions that analysts rightly ask about the current government in the UK is why it has pursued an austerity strategy far more radical than that pursued in most of the rest of Europe, and certainly far more radical than that pursued even in the US, although it may not feel like that to you right now, and is doing so despite the fact that even now the International Monetary Fund is saying, no, you need to stop, you need to invest in some things. But what it's doing is employing the classic shock doctrine and using austerity to bring about really quite a remarkable transformation in the ways in which all sorts of aspects of government and public service delivery in this country work. It's using it to remove schools from local authority controls and to create a growing market in the private provision of public education. It's using it to do the same in universities. It's using it to do the same in health. But it's doing so not, I think, just to save money, and also, not though significantly, not only to enable the generation of profit by private providers in hitherto unavailable areas. It's also doing it out of a deep commitment to this idea that everything about collective action and the state was a dead hand. Now that we understand, because the neurologists have told us and the evolutionary psychologists have told us, now that we understand that people are fundamentally these innovative, original, creative beings, then we've just got to free them to be innovative, original, celebrate those who are, teach everyone else to be so, force them if we must, and then we're going to live in a new utopia, which I presumably would be one in which we're all listening to you too all the time.
Who knew Bono was such a world historical figure?
Indeed, yes.
That was Alan Finlayson, Professor of Political and Social Theory at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's the author of Cameron, Culture and the Creative Class, The Big Society and the Post-Bureaucratic Age, which appeared last year in the journal The Political Quarterly. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the 1965 Rolling Stones single, It's the Singer, Not the Song, a title lifted from a 1961 British movie. Next up is Betsy Hartman, director of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. At the Left Forum in New York last weekend, I was chairing a panel on catastrophism, the title of the collection edited by Sasha Lilly, along with two other contributors to the volume, Eddie Ewan and Jim Davis. In the midst of an excellent conversation among panel and audience about the climate crisis, somebody piped up to say how badly we needed to reduce the human population by 2 billion. You often hear this sort of thing when enviros get together, but fortunately Betsy Hartman, whom I just met, was in the audience. So as chair, I was able to say, Betsy, could you take this? And she delivered an excellent brief response to the audience member, who, if truth be told, came off like a bit of a misanthrope. So I asked Betsy after the session if she could come on the radio and discuss that world historical reactionary Thomas Malthus and his lingering appeal. Betsy Hartman. Welcome, Betsy. I think we should start by reminding people who Thomas Malthus was. We certainly hear the word Malthusianism a lot, but some sense of who he was and what he stood for might be helpful.
Well, he was a British clergyman turned economist. He wrote at the end of the 1700s, beginning of the 1800s. And Malthus came from a erudite and, you know, upper middle class family in the UK. He ended up, his first job was in the church, and he was actually the curate of a small chapel that I visited in England in Oakwood. And there he observed that there were more births and deaths among his very poor parishioners. And from that observation, some of his biographers say, he came up with the idea of overpopulation, that humans' population growth grew exponentially or geometrically, while food production grew in a linear fashion, so that population always outpaced food production, leading to overpopulation, misery, poverty, and that starvation, war, were natural checks on population growth, and that the ruling classes perhaps could curb population growth through marrying late, but the poor people basically were responsible for their own misery. Well, Malthus went on to leave the church and to become, you know, what one say is the many people say is the father of the dismal science of economics. He also worked and taught at the East India College in London and was responsible for training colonial officers who went off to India, for example. So he's had a huge impact, even though he wrote way back when. His ideas are still very influential in international policy circles as well as popular culture.
It's interesting that even just from that sketch, he had his initial insight by observing poor people. So there's a class bias to him from the outset.
Absolutely. And, of course, a gender bias, too, you know. I often think about, you know, what a difference it would have made if he actually bothered to talk to his parishioners about why they were poor, or talk to the women about why they were having many children. You know, infant mortality rates were quite high in that period, but those kinds of questions he never asked. And interestingly, his father was much more liberal and, you know, had was friends with many kind of progressive thinkers of his time, but not Malthus.
And historically, he's been associated with pretty reactionary political forces, hasn't he?
Yes. Well, certainly in the UK, he argued against the poor laws, which were a form of charity to the poor. Basically, he said that they would allow poor people then to, you know, continue overbreeding. So that was one way. And another facet of Malthus's thinking that's often overlooked is the way he kind of justified war, or saw war as kind of a natural check on population growth. But most of the wars he talks about, if you look at his writings, he derives his kind of views of human nature from the global south and from colonial accounts of like the warring savages. So there's very much also kind of a Western view of, you know, poor colonial subjects as being savages and more prone to war that runs through his writings as well.
And he had a direct association with the East India Company.
Yes, he taught at their college.
So he got an earful from all these colonial officers he was training.
Yes, and I suppose he gave them an earful, too. And, of course, if you, you know, for example, look at Mike Davis's book, The Late Victorian Holocaust, you can find examples where his kind, Malthus's thinking actually informed colonial policy, for example, during a big famine in India, you know, in the late 1800s.
And people back in the 18th century are far less discreet than they are today. I mean, his population control policy was basically that the poor should die.
Yes, although, you know, later he started to develop, you know, he saw late marriage working, for example, in Scandinavia. But I think he saw that as more for kind of the Nordic types, right? For the upper middle classes, it was possible. But yes, for the poor, you know, basically, you know, perhaps if they worked hard enough and they could, you know, improve their lot. But generally, it was a rather dismal view of their future.
Some spirit of this has been adopted by parts of the environmental movement in the First World, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And also, not just in the First World, but, for example, there's, you know, strong Malthusian streams in some sectors of the environmental movement in India, for example. So, yeah, very powerful thinking. The U.S. environmental movement, especially, you know, with Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, but even starting earlier with books like by William Vogt, you have this kind of really doomsday view of population pressure as contributing to environmental degradation, resource scarcity, and war. And that remains today. I mean, it, you know, the environmental movement is complex, obviously, and some people hold these ideas simultaneously. I mean, I find it kind of fascinating that you'll find American environmentalists who will quite clearly see the roots of environmental degradation in their own communities. You know, for example, a developer coming in and raising down a forest to build a new sub-development or, you know, a problematic incinerator. But then they might not take that kind of power analysis and apply it to the Global South, and instead they just see the Global South as too many poor people.
Talk some more about Ehrlich and the population bomb, because that's what really, I think, launched this thinking into the big time.
Yes. Well, he wrote that book in 1968. It was supported by the Sierra Club. He was also well-liked by a guy named Hugh Moore, who wrote the first population bomb pamphlet, actually, who was the head of the Dixie Cup Corporation, who, you know, poured money into the nascent population movement. For example, the first Earth Day that came about in the States in 1970, this Hugh Moore guy thought that not enough was being done on population control and actually supported Ehrlich and Ehrlich's work getting out to a broad audience.
And this is rich coming from a guy who made a fortune off disposable paper cups.
I know, don't you love it? The ironies are, you know, many ironies in this field. But anyway, so Ehrlich wrote this book. It was a bestseller. It starts off when he's in Delhi and he's just feeling people. There's so many people surrounding their taxi, and he feels scared, and this is the feeling of overpopulation. And I have an Indian environmentalist friend who often laughs and says, you know, the real problem was the taxi spewing, you know, carbon fumes and the lack of public transportation. It wasn't all the people around, you know.
In that passage is a real deep misanthropy.
I agree, and especially misanthropy towards poor people in India. I mean, you often find actually in textbooks that are used in high schools in the United States, you'll find images of like densely crowded, third world slums or traffic scenes, and they're painted to be awful. And then you'll find a picture of, you know, Tokyo or New York, which are equally densely populated, but they're the kind of gleaming metropolises. So we have, you know, a density of what kind of people.
And you, of course, can't see the ecological damage that New York or Tokyo does elsewhere.
Exactly. Yeah, we're really taught to, we've done a lot of work at the Population and Development Program in Hampshire College looking at, how population is taught in schools and colleges. And if you look at these textbooks, it's actually quite amazing the visual imagery that's used, and, of course, in population organizations also.
At the core of this analysis is that that there are just too many people, and we can't do anything about the ecological crisis until there are fewer people.
Yes, and there is still a belief around. In fact, I ask my students every fall, do you think population grows exponentially? And they say yes. There's very little understanding here in the United States that birth rates have come down all over the world. Average global family size right now is about 2.45 children. Of course, there are still some pockets of high fertility in the world, but basically we are starting to converge on, either two children or less per family as the global average. So the population explosion, if we ever want to use that term, it's over, and people don't even realize that. So how are you going to, I was at a conference recently where a guy said we need to reduce the population by 2 billion people. Well, how are you going to do that when, birth rates are already slowing down so much? It's not going to happen. And, of course, the real roots of the environmental crisis have to do with, political, economic, social, gender inequalities, and not with the absolute numbers of people.
I'm speaking with Betsy Hartman, director of the Population and Development Institute at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And, of course, the regions of the world that do the most ecological damage, the rich countries, have very slow population growth. So I guess the U.S. is an outlier on that. But, Western Europe and Japan certainly flat or even declining populations.
Right. And ironically, around 2007, 2008, trying to get renewed focus on population growth, some of the population environment organizations in the in Washington, D.C., started saying things like, you know, we needed to reduce high fertility in Africa in order to address climate change. You know, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa does still have countries with relatively high fertility rates, partly because of poverty and inequality. But the idea that somehow reducing the birth rates of Africans, who, you know, have like the least carbon footprint on the planet, is somehow going to mitigate climate change was just absurd, you know. And in fact, it was so absurd, they're starting to move away from that. But nevertheless, you know, there's this, still this image that somehow if we can reduce population growth, it's going to magically solve the climate and environmental crisis. Well, it's not. And the current projections are by the UN that we're probably going to, you know, reach a peak of population between 9 and 10 billion people, and then it will start to level off or decline. So my argument, and partly the reason we have this is because there's so many young people of reproductive age in the current world population. There's a demographic momentum built into our numbers. So my argument is we need to plan for the addition of those additional people on the planet, and they're going to, you know, barring a major, you know, catastrophe or nuclear war, they're going to be here. So why, you know, just create all this fear and alarm that these people are going to be born, and instead really get down to the business of, you know, addressing the climate crisis and addressing environmental problems?
We're talking about another 2 or 3 billion people. Where is that going to happen?
Probably, India, even though India's birth rate's starting to come towards down toward 2, children per family, they'll probably be, you know, because of the age structure of the population, there'll be more people added to the population of India, and certainly in parts of Africa, likely to see a big rise in population. Those would be the main locations.
And what's been happening in China?
In China, there's this draconian one-child policy, which in some cases people are allowed to have two children if they're ethnic minorities or if they are living in the countryside and their first child is a girl. But, you know, the one-child policy has forced especially many urban Chinese to just have one child. So in China right now, the population is declining, and negative population growth, and the population growth rate. And the irony is that the Chinese government is now getting extremely concerned that they're not going to have enough workers to sustain their elderly population. So they're actually encouraging some children that both come from one-child families and get married to have two children. But a lot of, in urban areas, people have decided they only want one children because they don't have enough space. They're both working, whatever. So the irony is now the Chinese are recognizing that they have maybe have created a huge problem in terms of the labor force and certainly in terms of skewed sex ratios. They've created an enormous problem, not to mention the human rights implications of the kind of draconian policies that they followed. And many Chinese demographers will tell you that birth rates were already coming down in China, that one-child policy was not necessary. As development proceeded, you know, people were having fewer children, and that it was actually just a horrible experiment in population control with just tragic human consequences.
The Chinese government is not known for half measures.
No.
What kind of policies do your population control environmentalists advocate, and what are their impacts on what kinds of people?
Well, I think, you know, we're at a tricky moment right now because the International Women's Health Movement back in the early 90s, late 80s, really fought to reform and transform population policy so that family planning programs became integrated into reproductive health and women's empowerment and didn't have these population control objectives. And so there was some success at the 1994 UN conference in Cairo changing population policy to be more respectful of women's rights and health. The trouble is there wasn't that much money around to implement these new style programs. I mean, people tried. The field has changed over time. There are many, good family planning programs, and I certainly don't want to argue against family planning here. But the population control people who really wanted to kind of keep this single-minded focus on reducing birth rates, usually through long-acting contraceptive methods or sterilization, and contraceptive targets, they retained power in the field and they're resurgent again. Yet the discourse is very much about women's rights and, you know, we just need to empower women through family planning, and we won't use coercion, and everything's just going to be great. But the trouble is when you look at the actual programs in the field, I mean, they vary widely. Some are good and some really aren't so good. And at the moment, there's a renewed push for population control, to bring back population control as the centerpiece of family planning. So women's rights and reproductive rights activists are extremely worried about this new development. And you, for example, you have the Gates Foundation pushing Depo-Provera into Africa when Depo-Provera has studies show that it may be associated with doubling the risk of acquiring HIV. Really not a good method to be pushing into Africa right now. Yet there is this, you know, the Gates Foundation believes that population control, reducing population growth is necessary for sustainability, for political stability, for reducing poverty, et cetera.
Now, of course, many environmentalists will say there's just not enough resources in the world to feed and clothe this numbers of human beings, and that there's just, you know, not enough water even. What do you say to that kind of argument?
Well, I think if you look, I mean, there are studies showing where, you know, that the, you know, richest 10% of the world's population consumes, what, 60% of the world's resources or something like that. When you look at figures like that, or you look at the role of military in gobbling up resources, you have to really ask, is the problem that there aren't enough resources, or is it the distribution of resources, and also the kinds of technological development that take place? Couldn't we invest more in renewable technologies, for example, and renewable energy? So, in terms of water, I mean, if you look at water use, a lot of water is wasted through industrial agriculture and industrial practices that are highly wasteful. So it's not necessarily the individual person that is consuming all the water. We have to look at, like, the systems of production, of industrial production, of agricultural production, and see who is really using the resources. And it's not just individuals, like I said. It's, you know, it's companies, it's militaries. So the phenomenal overconsumption of the rich, too. We can certainly not ignore that. Or just say, you know, in terms of transport systems, do we look at, you know, is it the private automobile the way to go, or is it, you know, rapid public transit with, using alternative energy sources? I mean, there are real choices to be made here. And we're not, like, I don't believe we're, you know, nearing the end of resources, frankly.
Well, you'd almost think that the hidden agenda of the population control people was to be able to preserve that inequality of consumption.
Consciously hidden agenda, or it's an unconscious one, it certainly is an irony. But now we're also seeing a kind of bizarre development in the United States. There's something called GINCS, Green Incline No Kids, where upper middle class women are saying they're not going to have any children, or feeling guilty about having children, because these children are going to be hyper consumers of the American variety and therefore destroy the environment. So there's almost like this kind of population control that they're imposing on themselves. So that's a bizarre development right now, too. And again, it's blaming women, it's blaming children for what, for not looking, you can raise your children not to be hyper-American consumers, for example, you know? So it's kind of a problematic new development that discourse is being used at the same time as the discourse about the global south. And in a way, it makes us feel like, oh, you know, or we're going to reduce our consumption, or we're going to have fewer children, so therefore we're noble, so therefore those people over there should have less children, you know?
Well, the environmental crisis is not something that really admits of individualist solutions.
Yeah, no, absolutely, you know. I mean, I'm all for reducing energy consumption, for energy conservation, for retrofitting our houses, for doing everything we can, but that's not going to solve the crisis. I mean, it helps, but it is, you know, just a drop in the bigger bucket of who's really gobbling up the resources. The Pentagon is the biggest consumer of fossil fuels, transportation fossil fuels in the world. I mean, I think we have to think about that.
Yeah, well, they're flying gasoline into Afghanistan. It's grotesque. Well, let's conclude by returning to Malthus. What do you think is the source of his recurring appeal?
Well, I think it is an ideology that blames the poor for their own poverty, and it blames the poor for environmental degradation as well, and for war. And it totally obscures the power dynamics that exist between rich and poor, between men and women, between North and South. So it's a very productive ideology because it both obscures and blames at the same time. So it really turns our attention away from inequality and power issues. So it's very potent, and that's why it keeps coming up. A friend of mine describes it as a rhizome type of plant, you know, that travels underground and keeps popping up whenever it's needed. And, of course, it's often used against people of color, so it's racial dimensions. We cannot ignore that as well.
That was Betsy Hartman, Director of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this for the new album by Miss Kitten. Till next week, bye.
I'm falling inside. 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 I'